everybody on the Rainbow Warrior was apprehensive. Any civil disobedience is a serious matter.
The leader of Iran has greater democratic representation than George Bush has in the United States.
Inspections cannot be expected to achieve disarmament when a country has an active program of denial and deception, as is the case with Iraq.
Our Iraqi counterparts are fond of saying that there are no prescribed items, and if no evidence is presented to the contrary, they should have the benefit of the doubt.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch from Monday, January 27th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix issued his much-anticipated report on the progress of weapons inspections in Iraq to the UN Security Council today, and the verdict is not the best news Baghdad could have received. Blix told the council that Iraq seems to be cooperating with the inspectors, but he described Saddam Hussein's cooperation as lackluster, saying that Iraq has not genuinely disarmed. Blix once again urged Iraq to declare its weapons program components, especially those that may still exist.
I turn now, Mr. President, to the key requirement of cooperation and Iraq's response to it. Cooperation might be said to relate to both substance and process. It would appear from our experience so far that Iraq has decided in principle to provide cooperation on process, notably access. A similar decision is indispensable to provide cooperation on substance in order to bring the disarmament task to completion through the peaceful process of inspection, and to bring the monitoring task on a firm course. An initial minor step would be to adopt the long overdue legislation required by the resolutions. I shall deal first with cooperation on process. In this regard, it has regard to the procedures, mechanism, infrastructure, and practical arrangements to pursue inspections and seek verifiable disarmament. While inspection is not built on the premise of confidence, but may lead to confidence if it is successful, there must nevertheless be a measure of mutual confidence from the very beginning in running the operation of inspection. Iraq has, on the whole, cooperated rather well so far with UNMOVIC in this field. The most important point to make is that access has been provided to all sites we have wanted to inspect, and with one exception, it has been prompt. We have further had a great help in building up the infrastructure of our office in Baghdad and the field office in Mosul. Arrangements and services for our plane and our helicopters have been good. The environment has been workable. Our inspections have included universities, military bases, presidential sites, and private residences. Inspections have also taken place on Fridays, the Muslim day of rest, on Christmas Day and New Year's Day. These inspections have been conducted in the same manner as all other inspections. We seek to be both effective and correct. The substantive cooperation required relates above all to the obligation of Iraq to declare all programs of weapons of mass destruction and either to present items and activities for elimination or else to provide evidence supporting the conclusions that nothing proscribed remains. Paragraph 9 of Resolution 1441 states that this cooperation shall be, quote-unquote, active. It is not enough to open doors. On 7th of December 2002, Iraq submitted a declaration of some 12,000 pages in response to paragraph 3 of Resolution 4041, and within the time stipulated by the Security Council. In the fields of missiles and biotechnology, the declaration contains a good deal of new material and information covering the period from 1998 and onward. This is welcome. One might have expected that in preparing the declaration, Iraq would have tried to respond to, clarify, and submit supporting evidence regarding the many open disarmament issues which the Iraqi side should be familiar with from the UNSCOM documents 99-94 and the so-called Amorim report of March 1999. These are questions which UNMOVIC, governments, and independent commentators have often cited. While UNMOVIC has been preparing its own list of current unresolved disarmament issues and key remaining disarmament tasks in response to requirements in the Resolution 1284, We find the issues listed in the two reports I mentioned as unresolved, professionally justified. These reports do not contend that weapons of mass destruction remain in Iraq, but nor do they exclude that possibility. They point to a lack of evidence and inconsistencies which raise question marks, which must be straightened out if weapons dossiers are to be closed and confidence is to arise. They deserve to be taken seriously by Iraq rather than being brushed aside as evil machinations of UNSCOM. Regrettably, the 12,000-page declaration, most of which is a reprint of earlier documents, does not seem to contain any new evidence that will eliminate the questions or reduce their number. Even Iraq's letter sent in response to our recent discussions in Baghdad to the President of the Security Council on 24th of January does not lead us to the resolution of these issues. Our Iraqi counterparts are fond of saying that there are no proscribed items, and if no evidence is presented to the contrary, they should have the benefit of the doubt, be presumed innocent. UNMOVIC, for its part, is not presuming that there are proscribed items and activities in Iraq. But nor is it, or I think anyone else after the inspections between 1991 and 98, presuming the opposite, that no such items and activities exist in Iraq. Presumptions do not solve the problem. Evidence and full transparency may help.
Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix reporting to the UN Security Council. The director of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Mohammed El-Baradei, was charged with verifying the existence of and the destruction of Iraq's nuclear weapons program. El-Baradei said there was no evidence so far that Iraq was reviving its nuclear program and asked for a few months to complete the search. El-Baradei asserted that before the inspectors were withdrawn in 1998, Iraq was effectively disarmed. He said, quote, "We were confident that we had not missed any significant components of Iraq's nuclear program. We had neutralized its nuclear weapon program, and there were no indications that Iraq retained any capability to produce weapon-usable nuclear material." El-Baradei responded to questions raised about Iraq's attempt to buy aluminum tubes.
"We have inspected all of those buildings and facilities that were identified through satellite imagery as having been modified or constructed over the past 4 years. Zion inspectors have been able to gain ready access and to clarify the nature of the activities currently being conducted in these facilities. No prohibited nuclear activities have been identified during these inspections. A particular issue of focus has been the attempted procurement by Iraq of high-strength aluminum tubes and the question of whether these tubes, if acquired, could be used for the manufacture of nuclear centrifuge. Iraqi authorities have indicated that their unsuccessful attempts to procure the aluminum tubes related to a program to reverse engineer conventional rockets. To verify this information, the IAEA inspectors have inspected the relevant rocket production and storage sites, taken tube samples, interviewed relevant Iraqi personnel, and reviewed procurement contracts and related documents. From our analysis to date, it appears that the aluminum tubes would be consistent with the purpose stated by Iraq and, unless modified, would not be suitable for manufacturing centrifuges. However, we are still investigating this issue. It is clear, however, that the attempt to acquire such tubes is prohibited under Security Council Resolution 687. Inspections are time-consuming. I should mention that even in the case of South Africa, where full and active cooperation was forthcoming, it took the IAEA about 2 years to complete the process in that country. If inspection, however, is successful, it can ensure disarmament through peaceful means. It is worth recalling that in our past experience in Iraq, the elimination of its nuclear weapon program was mostly accomplished through intrusive inspection. Mr. President, to conclude, we have to date found no evidence that Iraq has revived its nuclear weapon program since the elimination of the program in the 1990s. However, our work is steadily progressing and should be allowed to run its natural course. With our verification system now in place, barring exceptional circumstances, And provided there is a sustained, proactive cooperation by Iraq, we should be able, within the next few months, to provide credible assurance that Iraq has no nuclear weapon program.
Mohammed El-Baradei, director of the International Atomic Energy Agency, reporting to the UN Security Council in New York. The Bush administration dismissed Iraq cooperation as inadequate, and U.S. Ambassador John Negroponte said he had heard nothing that gave any hope that Iraq will disarm voluntarily. Negroponte cites specific instances of noncompliance and characterizes them as evidence of violation of U.N. Resolution 1441, specifically documents found in the home of an Iraqi scientist.
In the past few weeks alone, inspectors found 12 chemical warheads that should have been in the declaration but were not. They also found 3,000 pages of secret Iraqi government documents, documents I would note that should have been included in the declaration but were not, hidden in the home of an Iraqi scientist. This is physical evidence that Iraq's declaration is inaccurate and incomplete. In terms of cooperation, there is an entire state apparatus in Iraq whose sole purpose is to obstruct the inspections. Inspectors are outnumbered by minders, sometimes by as many as 5-1, each time they head out on a mission. Iraq has canceled interviews and has refused Dr. Blix's request to employ the U-2 reconnaissance aircraft. A clear violation of Resolution 1441. They are not cooperating unconditionally. We believe the Council and its member governments must face its responsibilities and consider what message Council irresolution sends to Iraq and other proliferators. It benefits no one to let Saddam think he can wear us down into business as usual, as he has practiced it over the past 12 years. Thank you very much.
Then, you know, which way America will go? Will go unilaterally or still wants to work with the Security Council?
We're going to go into these consultations now and again on Wednesday, and I'm sure that there'll be more on all of this as the situation unfolds.
U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. John Negroponte. Asked whether the threat from Saddam Hussein was imminent, White House spokesman Ari Fleischer said, from the president's point of view, it remains a very grave threat. Secretary of State Colin Powell was likewise critical.
Dr. Blix said, Iraq appears not to have come to a genuine acceptance, not even today, of the disarmament that was demanded of it. 1441 is all about the disarmament demanded of Iraq. The inspector's findings came as no surprise. For 11 years before 1441, Saddam Hussein's regime refused to make the strategic decision, the political decision, to disarm itself of weapons of mass destruction and to comply with the world's demands. The Iraq regime continues to defy the will of the United Nations. The Iraq regime has responded to 1441 with empty claims, empty declarations, and empty gestures. Today we heard that the inspectors have not been able to interview any Iraqi in private. A clear message to Iraq that the will of the international community must be obeyed. The other members of the Security Council who voted unanimously for this resolution had the hope that Iraq would take this one last chance presented to it by the international community to disarm peacefully. Iraq has been and continues to be in material breach of all of its earlier obligations. We are giving, the resolution said, one more chance to Iraq. We put a firm list of conditions for Iraq to meet and what they should allow the inspectors to do to assist them in that disarmament. And let's not forget the vital part of the resolution. There would be serious consequences for continued Iraqi violation of its obligation. Time is running out. We've made it clear from the very beginning that we could not allow the process of inspections to string us out forever. If there isn't that kind of active cooperation, you could be sitting on the things you know and looking on the things you know about, but there may be many other things that you don't know about that you're unable to get information on. And so inspections only work in the presence of cooperation, active cooperation, and a willingness on the part of the other side to participate in the disarmament.
Secretary of State Colin Powell. Meanwhile, the Iraqi ambassador to the UN, Mohammed al-Duri, outlined exactly what inspectors have found in the country. He reiterated Iraq's willingness to comply with the international community and dismissed U.S. intelligence reports on Iraq's noncompliance with UN Resolution 1441, a key to any burden of proof the Bush administration may try to utilize for the invasion of Iraq.
More than 440 inspections were carried out to more than 297 sites. 3,392 inspections, 2,359 hours of interviews with 1,378 persons, and 10,256 inspection visits. Now there are 237 inspectors and officials from ANMOVIC and IAEA in Iraq. All the sites that the United States and Britain alleged in their two recent reports that were producing weapons of mass destruction, the result to prove that Iraq is clear of weapons of mass destruction. The inspectors also proved that all the intelligence information provided later by the United States and Britain were baseless. We should keep in mind that the Security Council disarmament panel stated in 1999 that these remaining disarmament issues could be dealt with after the suspension of sanctions.
Iraqi ambassador to the UN, Mohammed al-Duri. As it became evident over the weekend that the UN weapons report would contain no smoking gun, the Bush administration reverted to an old but unsubstantiated accusation that Saddam Hussein was supplying weapons to al-Qaeda to further its campaign of terrorism. WBAI reporter Robert Knight has more from New York.
In a stunning case of ideological whiplash, Washington reversed course this week from its insistence on a new authorization for war from the UN Security Council to an old allegation that Iraq was in league with the al-Qaeda network. The rhetorical makeover began Sunday in Davos, Switzerland, where Secretary of State General Colin Powell told the World Economic Forum that, quote, "The more we wait, the more chance there is for this dictator with clear ties to terrorist groups, including al-Qaeda, more time for him to pass a weapon, share a technology, or use these weapons again," end quote. Monday afternoon, that charge was repeated by White House spokesperson Ari Fleischer, who asserted that the alleged Iraqi al-Qaeda link had come up during prisoner interrogations at Guantanamo. But under questioning by the White House press corps, Fleischer was unable to provide proof.
I don't even know if transcripts are taken in that sense. I don't know that there's a White House stenographer sitting there in that sense. I'll be happy to take your question up with other people here, but I give you the information because that's where we have it.
Well, may not be talking about a specific transcript, but typically in any kind of interview situation, some sort of report, I presume, is made. Why wouldn't you disclose that? Why wouldn't that help your case?
I think I just did disclose to you the germane part of it.
But you haven't disclosed the details of it, and that would certainly...
As I indicated, this is an ongoing situation, and I think that there may be more to be said at the appropriate time.
It strikes me as smelling a little bit of desperation.
William Rivers Pitt is a writer for truthout.org and the author of the book War on Iraq. According to Pitt, the idea of an alliance between Iraq and al-Qaeda is intrinsically ludicrous.
The fact of the matter is that Saddam Hussein is a secular dictator. He's been crushing Islamic fundamentalism in Iraq for the last 30 years. It's one of the main reasons why he goes after the Kurds. It's one of the main reasons why he went to war with Iran back in the 1980s. If you proselytize for fundamentalist Islam, particularly the Wahhabi sect of fundamentalist Islam, which is practiced by Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, you'll be killed in Iraq. Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda have said on many occasions that they would very much like to see Saddam Hussein dead. The last thing in the whole wide world that he is going to do is to give them any kind of weapons or aids, because if he gave them weapons, they would use those weapons on him first.
This is not the first time the administration has tried to tie Iraq to al-Qaeda, but even their own agents have been unable to prove the case. On September 10, 2002, 2 days before Bush's major speech on Iraq, Vincent M. Canestraro, the former head of the CIA's counterterrorism office, told the Washington Post that there was no confirmed evidence of an Iraqi link to terrorism, echoing an August 2 report in the Los Angeles Times that the FBI had also failed to tie Iraq to al-Qaeda. Powell's weekend claim of a weapons transfer from Baghdad to al-Qaeda was specifically refuted last March when even a senior British military official told The Independent that, quote, "We are not aware of evidence, intelligence, or otherwise, that the Iraqi government or its agencies are passing on weapons of mass destruction to al-Qaeda, nor have we seen any credible evidence linking the Iraqi government to the September 11th attacks," end quote. Then, on July 30th, former Weapons Inspector Richard Butler, known for his close ties to U.S. intelligence, told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that, quote, "I have seen no evidence of Iraq providing weapons of mass destruction to non-Iraqi terrorist groups," end quote. Neither, according to William Pitt, is there a significant basis for allegations that Iraq has harbored members of al-Qaeda.
Iraq is a fairly large nation. There is not a lot of Iraqi control in the north and the south, so it's very possible that these groups have passed through those areas the way that they certainly passed through Syria, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, the Palestinian area, Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and much of the rest of that region. There's a fairly large leap between these independent organizations passing through these areas and Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi government actively aiding them.
Pitt says that if Washington were at all serious about stopping al-Qaeda and allied organizations, it would do better to join Iraq rather than fighting it.
If we were a wise government, we would work with these countries to try to track these people down instead of get all belligerent and say with us or against us and work against ourselves in trying to bring this particular situation under control.
William Rivers Pitt is the author of War on Iraq. And in New York, I'm Robert Knight.
The U.S. plans for war against Iraq, according to a CBS News report, states that the damage will be as devastating as a nuclear attack. Political columnist Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen of Pacific Station WBAI in New York offer these thoughts on that matter.
They are calling it A-Day. A as in airstrikes, so devastating that according to a Pentagon official, quote, "there will not be a safe place in Baghdad. The sheer size of this," he continued, "has never been seen before, never been contemplated before. On the first day, the U.S. Air Force and Navy will launch between 300 and 400 cruise missiles against the Iraqi people. And on the second day, the plan calls for launching another 300 to 400. This plan for rapid dominance, called Shock and Awe, was developed by the National Defense University. As Harlan Ullman, one of its authors, remarked, "it's like nuclear weapons at Hiroshima. Not taking days or weeks, but minutes."
It should be kept in mind, Maya, that the 400 missiles, cruise missiles, that they intend to launch in the first few minutes of the first day and to replicate on the second day, that is the total number of cruise and Tomahawk missiles that were launched in the entire 40 days of the Gulf War, which led to the devastation of Iraq. And one of the important consequences of this, we should point out, is that these missiles and their cone warheads are coated with depleted uranium, which in all essence is a tactical nuclear weapon, because it aerosols and the radioactivity permeates the aquifer and the soil. It gets into the food chain, and it has resulted in an epidemic of congenital deformities in hospitals across Iraq. Children are now being born with thalidomide-like deformities, without heads, with stumpy arms, with their backs laid open, with their organs displaced. It is a nightmare of Hiroshima-like effects, but on a vast scale affecting millions of people.
Also, Ralph, over 30% of U.S. Gulf War veterans have applied and received from the Department of Veterans Affairs benefits based upon their service in the Gulf War.
And this report, which is carried on CBS News and on Reuters and on ABC, says we're going to take the city down. You're sitting in Baghdad, and all of a sudden, the city has been taken down. Within 2 days, they are physically, emotionally, and psychologically devastated. And in today's San Francisco Chronicle, let it be mentioned, there is a major article called "Iraq's 13 million children are at grave risk of starvation, disease, death, and psychological trauma." And it is anticipated that there will be a destruction of the 500,000 children after the death of 750,000 as a result of the sanctions, with starvation in the aftermath for the 13 million children that are expected to survive.
The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees envisions, quote, a human disaster with 1 million refugees spilling into neighboring nations, 4.5 to 9.5 million Iraqis inside the country needing emergency food rations. As the militarists say, the goal of rapid dominance is to destroy the will to resist so that the Iraqi people have no alternative except to accept our strategic aims and military objectives.
Taking so ghastly a price in human suffering that no people can organize themselves socially, politically to represent or to organize for their own needs in the society. Imperialism requires it. It is a war against the people of the country and of the world.
This is
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen.
Students from over 60 campus peace groups converged on Washington, D.C. recently with the goal of forming a national student organization to oppose the war with Iraq. Over 400 student delegates were at Washington, D.C.'s George Washington University for the conference, while a similar number gathered on the West Coast. Tom Gomez from WBIX Radio spoke with students attending the conference from as far away as Texas. He files this report.
Student organizers from high schools as well as colleges across the nation had gathered here with a single purpose, to create a national student network to oppose any war in Iraq. The students had diverse political views and came from a variety of backgrounds. At this conference, at least, they set aside those differences in order to work together. Colette Kosner is a high school student from Amherst, Massachusetts.
We have a small group of anti-war protesters called Students for Peace. A lot of people aren't educated. We've been tabling with a lot of pamphlets and stuff from the AFSC. They give a lot of stuff about the draft and military recruitment. And one of the biggest problems is that people have one source that they go to find their information about current events, and that's the corporate-owned news. Therefore, they have a very biased source. The military recruiters are calling up people's houses. I feel like that's a violation. You know, all your information is sent to these recruiters.
Shannon Clark is a young wife and mother who traveled over 1,000 miles to attend the conference.
I'm Shannon Clark. I'm part of the anti-war group at the University of Texas. I'm a mother married to an ex-reservist. I've been concerned about the situation in Iraq since the first Gulf War. There's a huge opportunity to bring folks in by educating them, having a group that has a broad appeal, by not being too radical and not going so far as to say imperialism is bad, because you have to meet people where they are right now.
Jana is both a student organizer and a member of a Marxist party. She is already active with the anti-war organization Not in Our Name, which formed in the wake of September 11th.
I'm from New York with the Revolutionary Communist Youth Brigade. I'm really excited that there's a growing anti-war movement among students and youth, and we think it's a really important thing, especially here in the belly of the beast that's sort of unleashing this madness of war on the rest of the planet. We have a particular responsibility in this country to do something about what our own government is doing. Through my involvement with the Not in Our Name project, we've really felt that it's been important to come together with a lot of different people who view things differently, who can come together on a common basis. We have to stand with the people of the world, that we have to aim to actually stop this war that's being waged, along with the repression and the roundups of immigrants. It's going to take a lot of different forms of resistance, and we're glad to be out here with many different kinds of people today.
Students chose a name for the group at the conference. They decided to call themselves the National Campus Anti-War Network, or NCAN. They also elected delegates from the conference to convene later in the year in Chicago. For WBIX Refugees and Exiles Radio, this is Tom Gomez reporting.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment. Thank you.